pre-panel team are here. Hi, Zara.
Hello.
Hi, Jim.
Good afternoon, Jesse. How are you?
Wonderful, thanks.
Quarter to four. And Zara, shortly, what the world's talking about, touch typing versus two-fingered typing. Surprising findings. Wanted a new James Bond, the benefits or not of breakfast, and this is the latest research finding.
Great.
Animals entering our world, which is an obvious trend. There's something happening out there with evolution, don't you think, Zara? The latest statement of that, what animals are doing. What constitutes a gold record now that we don't really sell music anymore? Because you can get it with your phone now, can't you? That's the thing. On the panel today, Tim Watkin with Sue Wells. Let me just check this message. It says Sue Wells, ready in Christchurch. Hello, Sue.
Hello. How are you?
Very well. Nice to have you on.
Thank you.
The pros and cons of spending big on counselling in the wake of earthquakes. The ways we neglect our elderly. Do you get bored easily, and is that good or bad? What is the use of Twitter now that Stephen Fry has resigned from it again? A short thought in the second half from a listener about whether juries should know about a defendant's criminal background. Should our SAS soldiers be fighting in Iraq or Syria? And does the ability to distinguish the duck from the rabbit mean anything at all?
It's a bit like that dress, isn't it?
The gold versus the blue. Or perhaps not even like that. One quick question. Is it true that the Canterbury rebuild is counted into New Zealand's productivity count? Was the earthquake itself then counted as negative productivity? What about Auckland house price inflation? Nick Morris wants to know this. Eric Crampton, economist with the New Zealand Initiative.
The usual definition of productivity is the output divided by the input, and Auckland house price inflation is largely due to the cost of land, which will be factored into the cost of producing the house. When we turn to earthquakes, while the Canterbury earthquakes destroyed wealth, property, and lives, the rebuild boosted measured economic output, or GDP. But nobody would recommend bulldozing and rebuilding cities as a road to national prosperity. The earthquake rebuild could only boost productivity if it resulted in more output per unit of labor or capital. But it was harder to get anything done in Christchurch after the earthquakes. The same labor and materials produced rather less output when roads were impassable, you couldn't get to your office, and the whole place decided to jump up and down at unpredictable intervals.
Okay, so that's tricky. To sum it up, I could go to you on that, Sue, but I think what Eric said was fairly self-evident. Jim?
Well, the only other thing I would add, though, is he hasn't factored in overseas insurance money that was added into the economic mix.
We'll go back to him. Zara, will you make a note to go back to
him? I've got my pencil poised.
Right. Go back to Eric on that point. Jim, what proportion of the stars that we see on a clear night no longer exist, i.e. are dead?
Oh.
That is, they burned out or whatever happens to them since the light we see from them today was transmitted. Oliver Mudford, Panmure, Auckland.
That's a sad one.
It's an interesting one.
It's very interesting. Good question.
Dr. Ian Griffin, astronomer and director of the Otago Museum.
Most probably less than two of the stars you can see in the sky are no longer there. Now, on a clear moonless night, you can see roughly 3,000 stars, and the vast majority you can see are within 1,000 light years of us. Now, only the most luminous stars can be spotted at a greater distance. So when you look up at the night sky, light from the furthest stars you can see left them less than 10,000 years ago. Most are much closer. Now, you might think that at least some stars may have died since their light started its journey towards us. However, stars live much longer than 10,000 years, and even the shortest-lived stars burn for about 1 million years or more. That means that the odds of a star you can see happening to die while its light is already on its way to us are absolutely minuscule. In terms of a star's lifetime, a few thousand years is less than one beat of a human heart.
There you go.
Hooray!
That's cheery news, isn't it?
Yeah, sad day, glad day, just like that.
Only two stars are dead.
Phew.
And one quick question about anything at all, and we try and get the answer for you if you're emailing the panel at radionz.co.nz or if you're texting 2101. And just one more quick one, because we can answer this ourselves. Hello, I am a UK professional classical musician. My friend has asked me a question about your show. I have no idea what she's talking about. This is her question. Can you find out who wrote the sting for the panel on Radio NZ? Sounds like Nyman. As I have no idea what the sting is or who Nyman is, I cannot answer her question. Please, can you let me know so that I can? Thank you, Leslie Hoosen. Well, the panel's theme music is called Brightest Star, and the composers are English. They're Andrew Britton. I don't know if he's related to Benjamin. and David Goldsmith, and they specialise in film scores and TV soundtracks. And Michael Nyman, because we were curious, is also an English composer of similar vintage, also writes film scores, but also operas.
Lovely, Michael
Nyman. So we probably couldn't afford him. Zara Potts, what the world is talking about.
Can I interrupt here?
Yes.
Have you wished Zara a happy birthday today yet, Jim?
Well, I have in the office.
He gave me a recycled gift.
I came to work today and saw a birthday cake in the shape of an N, and I went around looking for the person whose name began with the N, and then I realised I was looking at the wrong way, and it was in fact a Z.
Happy birthday, Zara.
Thank you very much. Did you know that I share it with Kim Jong-il?
It's quite notable.
I know. Anyway, now, back when I was at high school, and you might have had this as well, which was a long time ago, you had to learn typing. It was one of those compulsory classes where you had to learn typing.
I always wish I did. Did you learn it too?
I learned it in third form, yes.
Was it not compulsory?
No.
Yeah. No, the Latin class only got it because Mr. Beetson, the Latin teacher, was also the one who was responsible for handing out the textbooks. Oh. So we got it for 2 weeks in fifth form. That was
wonderful. Did you have to type in Latin?
I'm trying desperately to think of the Latin word for yes, and I've stumped myself. Clearly it didn't take.
Well, a lot of people had to take typing at school. And actually, when you trained as a journalist, you had to learn to touch type. That was one of the prerequisites of getting into journalism schools, was having to do, I think, like 70 or 80 words a minute. And touch typing was supposed to be the quickest way of typing. But shock horror, new research out of Finland suggests that it may have all just been a waste of time. Because researchers at Aalto University have noticed, or they noticed, that there had been very little research into how people type in the real world, something that we now do more than ever. So they carried out the first study to compare the two, trained and untrained. And the recruits were just everyday typists aged between 20 and 55. Some were touch typists and some were not. And the results found that regardless of the number of fingers involved, an everyday typist may achieve entry speeds of more than 70 words per minute.
Really?
Yes. So even people who type with two fingers can achieve a level of performance you would expect from touch typists.
But surely the ability to look at the page and not at the keyboard all the time would speed you up.
It does, but they're saying that people, that it all depends on, it's not actually about the fingers and the looking at the screen, it's about how still you hold your palm. That's the secret to fast typing, apparently.
Would you copy type these days anyway? Which is what you do with when you're looking at the paper and you're typing it on the screen. I mean, there's
excellent
an awful
question,
lot to be said for cut and paste.
No, yeah. That's true. Yeah, that is true.
I don't think I do hold my palms still, just trying to visualise how I type.
No, well, before any of the professional typists out there start sending us quickly worded emails, the study did prove that fast competitive typing speeds above 120 words a minute can only be reached by touch typing. So only the touch typists can do that fast.
The trouble with two-finger typing is that you can type an entire line and then have a look at it and realise that you've done it all in capitals and have to start all over again.
That's true.
I thought it was interesting. My typing teacher at school was Mrs. Quirk. It was interesting. I had a typing teacher whose name was almost an entire line of the keyboard.
Yeah.
Mrs. Quirk. I had a maths teacher called Mr. Addington. I always thought that was quite good. Yeah.
J.R.R. Tolkien, says Carolyn from Oxford, typed Lord of the Rings with two fingers. He couldn't afford a typist.
Well, and that would have been in one of those old typewriters too, where you had to really bang them and like hit that thing that, you know, made it go ding.
Maybe
the return key.
The return. No, it was wasn't it before return keys, it was the thing where you had to actually hit the typewriter at the top of the typewriter and seven.
Yeah, the Watson. Yeah. It was called the Watson officially.
It was the silver dangly down thing that looked a bit like a uvula.
Exactly that. Yes. Oh, they were fun days of typing, weren't they?
Well, we didn't know any better. We didn't know what promise the golden future held.
Word processors.
Yeah.
Remember them.
I do.
Well, Jerry Lewis doing the typing song.
Oh, that's going back.
No real surprises here, but the word is that Daniel Craig has quit his role as James Bond.
Yay, I'm
yay on that too. The actor had been pretty spiky, actually, about doing any press for the last Bond instalment. He famously said that he'd rather slash his wrists than play 007 again. And it seems he's been true to his word. He is going to apparently be joining the cast of a new television series called Purity, which is based on Jonathan Franzen. And so he looks like he's out of the franchise. Bookies are already taking bets on who will be the next actor to play the spy, including names such as Tom Hardy, Damian Lewis, who seems to be in everything, and Idris Elba.
Again.
I thought Skyfall was the most magnificent piece of cinema I'd seen in a long time, and I thought Daniel Craig just took it to a new level. He made Bond real for me, incredible. And then that dreadful, dreadful last thing they did, it was like, oh, God, yuck, back in time, here we go. You could just about see him gagging as he was doing it.
What, Spectre? Isn't it funny how we all regard things differently?
Yeah. You loved it, didn't you?
You feel the opposite way.
No, I didn't much like Spectre, but I did love Casino Royale.
Which Bond was that?
The first one he did.
Was that? Oh, that was Daniel Craig, not, I'm thinking, Sean Connery.
It wasn't Idris Elba.
I always liked the Bond that was George Lazenby. No, he was way before my time. Who was the one? Roger Moore.
My movie critic's favourite Bond was George Lazenby.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah.
Is he the Australian?
Yeah.
Tarzan, wasn't he?
Now, the debate around whether breakfast is the most important meal of the day or not seems to never go out of fashion, and it seems science still has no definitive answer. We know that skipping breakfast does cause the brain to be more responsive to food, and that people who don't eat breakfast often eat more at lunch, but most studies show that no matter how big your lunch is, it still doesn't compensate for the kickstart to your metabolism that breakfast gives you. Now, a recent study has shown that eating breakfast will also give you more energy through the day, so not just the morning but all day long. So if you do eat breakfast, you will have much more energy at 4 o'clock, say, than if you didn't. If you don't eat breakfast, then you will reduce your levels of physical activity without even consciously realizing it.
The trouble is, there was research out last year saying if you skip breakfast, it assists weight loss.
Exactly. Mm. Well, this is the thing, is that there are benefits to eating breakfast in the morning, and there are also benefits to not eating breakfast in the morning. Prevailing wisdom suggests that you should, but the current state of scientific evidence means that this is still up for debate, so there's basically, it's up to you.
Carriage return.
Carriage return, that's what
thank
it's
you.
Called.
Thank you, thank you, thank you,
thank
you.
Jeff says, so was Tolkien the king of the return?
That's very good.
That is very good.
Now, you would think that Kanye West would have enough money not to have to hit up billionaires on Twitter, but after a surprise admission from the rapper saying that he was $53 million in personal debt, he has reached out to Mark Zuckerberg and Larry Page for help. Perhaps maybe reaching out for Mark Zuckerberg on Twitter isn't the best platform.
Yes, that's what attracted you to this story.
Well,
why is he going on Twitter?
Why is he on Twitter talking to Mark Zuckerberg? I mean, that's sort of the wrong platform. So, he's asked for $1 billion. He wants $1 billion to fund his ideas. He says he has some fantastic ideas for the world, and he can't afford to do it. And his wife has a separate bank account, apparently, so she's not helping him. They have separate finances, so she's not going to help him out
of
his $53 million.
He's not doing much to promote his finances, though, because he's got this new album out. He released it and then withdrew it. Now he's only releasing it on Tidal and some other reason as well. He's asking the white music press not to review it.
Not to review it. That's right.
It's Tidal Jay-Z's
The exclusive competitor to iTunes, sort of.
It's getting high priced, though, the life of Pablo.
Is it? I've seen mixed reviews.
Well, I haven't heard it, so I can't. I mean, the reviews don't entirely make sense, but there are a lot of reviewers who say it's magnificent.
Mm.
Well, don't feel too sorry for him. I'm sure he's got a few million in the bank that he can draw on.
A dentist named Mr. Payne. You see, these are coming in now. Everybody's got one.
Exactly. Now, the latest Good Country Index has just been released, and it's a pretty simple index, really. It's just a measure of what each country contributes to the common good of humanity. And the categories include such things as science and technology, culture, peace and security, prosperity and climate. And New Zealand is ranked the fifth good country in the world. So Ireland was number one overall, followed by Finland, Switzerland and the Netherlands. The least good country in the index was Libya. And that was backed up by Iraq, Azerbaijan and Angola.
How many of these jolly good country surveys are there? Good country survey every month.
This one is quite interesting, though, because it does rank countries pretty thoroughly. Like, they look at all sorts of things there. If you want to go and look at it, go to www.goodcountry.org. It's worth a look.
Goodcountry.org.
Goodcountry.org. It's quite good.
Very good. More from Sue Wells after four, and she's joined by Tim Watkin. Tomorrow on my show, I'll be talking to an expert about the flock of sharks that has showed up off the coast of Florida. Flock can't be right. Swarm
school.
Of sharks.
School.
School of sharks.
Flock.
Bird.
The bite of sharks. Catch you then.